Around this time, Heal decided to take a trip to Chicago. He had never been to the Windy City, but had heard plenty about it. Chicago and Detroit are inextricably tied to each other as capitals of the Rust Belt. Heald knew that somewhere west of him at any time was this massive mecca of the Midwest. Like so many Americans in tough times before him, there was a growing sense within Heald that if he just stood at the top of a high peak and looked westward, he would see golden pastures that marked a new beginning. He felt like some old prospector infected by a sense of manifest destiny, with westward expansion being the only option for some semblance of success in life. It's the age-old reaction to an age-old problem. Pick up, move yourself elsewhere, and see if your problems follow you like a lonely dog. The hope is that they stay back and attach themselves to some other unfortunate soul. With that in mind, Heald set forth to explore. As the bus made its way west along I-90 during the first trip to Chicago, Heald felt a rush of excitement and optimism that he had not experienced in a long time. Along the massive multi-lane expressway that leads into the city, there is a bridge over the Calumet River that gives the first glimpse of that incredible skyline. Heald wasn't expecting it to appear so soon after crossing the state border from Indiana into Illinois. But as the bus drove over the bridge, Heald leaned close to his window and got his first look at that awe-inspiring row of dynamic steel edifices rising from the earth. He remembered sunlight everywhere. And as he gazed at the glint off the vibrant mirrored structures, he thought he had spotted a glowing golden nugget. Few young people have come across this site and not been taken aback. The buildings looked new, the city expanding by the moment as the bus drew closer. They rounded the lake and made their way north up the Dan Ryan, the immense monolithic Sears Tower guiding them in like a beacon on some intellectual shoreline.
I love that line, that your problems follow you like a lonely dog. That's cool.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, they tend to do that.
They do. You know, your novel, actually, when I read it, you know what popped into my mind back from my high school years was Catch-22. There's something absurd about it. Satire, I guess, is, you know, if we want to label it. How do you refer to it?
I refer to it, I mean, Catch-22 is perfect. That happens to be one of my favorite novels of all time. I love the way Catch-22 is able to capture such serious issues and really focus on things that really needed to be highlighted, especially at the time with the war and things like that and the absurdity of war. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of wanted to do something like a Catch-22 using this sort of zany, off-the-wall kind of humor in certain parts to look at things that maybe hadn't been uncovered yet. And what I wanted to look at was office life, kind of the bureaucracy of the government and how it spiraled out of control. I know I wrote this book during the Obama administration and, you know, things were good. I'm a big supporter of Obama and everything that he was doing. But there seemed to just be kind of this sort of festering thing underneath what was going on in society at the time, this sort of backlash that was building. But so many of us were blind to it. I know I certainly was most of the time. But having kind of a darker mindset, sort of like a pessimistic kind of in a mindset towards things, sort of saw this thing building. And then now that we have arrived at the, you know, the time of Trump and this current administration, things seem perfect in Title 13. I mean, it's almost...
You know, I was going to ask you that, you know, and you've answered that, you know, during what years did you write this? And obviously it couldn't have been written in the last few months. So I thought, yeah, it's almost prophetic, this mad, mad world that you're describing. A lot of people would refer to today's political atmosphere that way.
Yeah, and it's really surprised me because, I know I finished the novel, I believe in 2015-ish, and then I started searching for a publisher after that. And, you know, that was right around the time when Trump was really making a lot of noise and being quite a blowhard. And so I thought, well, you know, this can't be where we're going. Like the rest of us, I thought, you know, this is a sideshow. This isn't something that's going to be to take over our political system. And then suddenly it started to catch wind. And I remember as I was editing the novel, I kind of thought, you know, this can't be. I was reading the novel over and I'm like, this the stuff that's happening in here seems so zany. I wrote this as fiction. I don't want this to come true. And so I remember, you know, about a month before the election, I was talking to my family and a few of my friends, and I said, I'm really terrified that I think Donald Trump is going to win. And it was just a small part of me. I wasn't wearing a sign on the street corner saying the end is near. But suddenly when it came true and it happened, and now these last few months getting ready for the publication of my book, I've just thought, oh, man, I wish I was wrong. I really wish I was wrong. But you know, I'm not saying I'm right on all counts. I'm definitely not. Certainly, usually not right about things. But this has been, oddly prophetic, sort of weird, and not in a comforting way at all.
So I'm going to have some suggestions on your second novel. Start
yes,
writing it
yes,
now.
Please. Yes, please. Yeah, I'm almost afraid to. I don't even want to see what else is possible.
So give our listeners a synopsis. What is this novel about?
Title 13 is it's a story that's set in downtown Chicago and also in Detroit. And it takes place in the summer of 2010. And the main character, Heald Brown, he works at the Chicago Regional Census Center. And so he works for a branch of the government within the Department of Commerce. And so it's kind of the classic struggle for a young man who's just starting out. He's got unrequited love. You know, he's in love with somebody who may or may not love him back. And it takes place during right after the recession, obviously, which was so impactful for many of us younger folks who were graduating around that time.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest focus of the novel, I think, is obviously Heald's struggle with addiction. He is an alcoholic, and the novel really looks at the way alcoholism affects his entire life, the way it affects his work life, the way it affects his love life and his family life. Everything that he does is kind of impacted by this devastating addiction. And so the novel starts off on a very kind of funny, sort of satiric note, and kind of unusual, sort of feeling like a whodunit, like what's going on here. And then as Heald's addiction becomes so obvious and prevalent, the novel really kind of gears towards a more emotional, and I don't really want to say dark, but yes, dark path towards Heald. And is he capable of redemption? Is he capable of love? Is he capable of being loved?
Mm-hmm.
And so it focuses on issues like that.
I think it was in the mid-300s that there's this really quite touching scene where the character Janice talks to your main character and confronts him about the alcohol. And I thought that was a compassionate and yet painful conversation. And they kind of take on relationships, too, which I thought was interesting, that some people get into relationships because you're afraid of being alone, not because mm-hmm. you fall in love with someone, but out of fear, driven out of fear. So I thought there was a lot in that little conversation.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, that's the type of conversation that I fear, or I think sometimes, you know, we have so much trouble in real life having conversations like that. But those are the most meaningful, the most emotionally heavy conversations. And, you know, so often in fiction, we get to create these conversations like this that we imagine in our heads. And that one was particularly interesting to write because it actually came very easily. It just sort of happened, you know. I guess by, like you said, it was later in the book. So at that point, I kind of had a mind for these characters, and I thought, you know, how would these two react if they really just had a bare bones, no holds barred kind of discussion about things that are really impacting them?
Yeah, it was very, very honest. Do you write on a typewriter? I think I saw somewhere, and on your website, you have this burning typewriter too. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Oh, I do. I do, actually. For the novel that I wrote, this was the first novel I've written, but I ended up writing it on a typewriter that I have. I have a bunch of these typewriters, kind of like a Tom Hanksy sort of obsession.
So you're a collector?
Well, I'm a collector of what I can afford. I think I have three. So that's the extent of my collection. And until I can, and you know, it's hard to find ones working in good condition, but I have a Olivetti Latera one that I really love. And I, the reason I enjoyed writing on the typewriter rather than my MacBook was it just, it really forces you to slow down. Every word that you write, every mark that you make with a typewriter, it's there. And, you know, it's not easy to get rid of. So you have to stop, you have to think, you have to process the words that you're going to write. And I also love the clickety-clack of the keys. I mean, it feels like you're working. Yeah, when you're writing on a laptop, you know, you just get that sort of dull little tap, 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 tap. But, you know, when you're on a typewriter,
and that satisfying little ding at the end of the line.
The ding. Oh, I love that ding. I wish I could implement that ding in so many parts of my life. You know, do the dishes, ding. Do this, ding. You know, make the bed, ding.
Oh, I love it.
That would be wonderful. But yeah, and of course, the added pleasure of not being distracted by the internet.
There you go.
That's
a biggie.
That is so crucial.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, maybe we should all go back to typewriters.
Yes, and it works when the power goes out, too. That's nice.
There you go. Yeah. So talk a little bit about your journey as a writer. When I looked into your bio, you have some history as a sports writer. You've written for CBS. And how did that move from that kind of writing to creative writing?
So when I was in college, I got a degree in creative writing from Michigan State. And I loved writing fiction. I loved writing short stories. And that was sort of my forte. And then once I graduated, you know, I graduated during that, you know, the horrible recession, and there was no jobs. There was absolutely nothing in writing. And so I ended up working in the government, of course, you know, because what could be more absurd, right? And so I ended up doing some, you know, office jobs, things like that. And then in my off time, my spare time after I got some of those jobs, I started writing sports. I'm also a big fan of the Michigan State Spartans. And so I got a job writing sports for them. And then that led to a few more jobs writing sports for these online outlets and certain newspapers online. And then that led to CBS. And I started writing articles for them and CBS Detroit. And that all kind of just kept going. One thing led to another, a different opportunity, a different opportunity. There was some music writing that I do and still do for another website. And all the meanwhile, you know, fiction has been what I love to do, but fiction can't pay the bills. You know, these other jobs, they could pay some bills, but these couldn't. So that basically, you know, I've had some fiction published elsewhere. And, you know, once that really started to take off with fiction, that led me to go, you know, well, novel, that's the next step. That's what I really want to do, is write a novel. And so that came out of that. So it was an odd circle, you know. It kind of started in college with fiction. And then I went around all this kind of nonfiction journalism sort of stuff, and then came back to the fiction. Maybe it was just the way the economy is, maybe, you know, the way what people are reading at certain times. I'm not sure, but I'm kind of glad it's come back full circle, because I still love sports and I still love, you know, writing about music and whatnot. But there's nothing more important, in my opinion, than good literature and fiction.
But now, what are you going to do if you're a Spartans fan and now you're working at U of M?
Oh, yes. That was a point of contention.
And they still hired you.
Yes. Oh, they did. Yeah, I had to hide that well into my resume. I don't know if they actually read that, luckily. But I'm the only Spartan in my family. My father, my mother, my sister are all big U of M fans. My sister went to U of M, and I'm the only Spartan. And so, you know, when I ended up getting a job at U of M, everybody was like, oh, my God, you're so lucky. You're the luckiest person in the world. And I, you know, I obviously felt very lucky. I mean, it's a wonderful job, but I just couldn't help but sort of get that dig in where I was like, yeah, you know, but Michigan State wasn't hiring, so what could I do? You know, I guess I'll have to work at U of M. I mean, and it's a wonderful school and a wonderful institution, but yeah, I just couldn't help but, you know, every time they bring that up with, they say, you know, you're the luckiest guy in the world. And I say, yeah, but you know, Michigan State is still out there somewhere. Don't forget that.
So back to Title 13, one of the aspects of it is how disjointed we are now as a society. Was that something that you wanted to convey, the kind of increasing loneliness that we have in our communities?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, this novel was written at a time when I kind of sort of started to feel separated from society myself, you know, with increasing tensions and polarization. Mm-hmm. I started to feel that way when I was writing it. Maybe that was just a me thing at the time, but now that our society is really polarized and just so divisive, everything between politics and there isn't a subject out there that it seems like people can't find a way to disagree on. And that really gets highlighted in Title 13.
Yeah.
The whole way that, you know, people just respond to each other. It's almost like there's an aura of paranoia everywhere, you know, between, I don't know if it's claims of fake news and all things like that. It's just, there's this wave of paranoia, I feel like, that's sweeping our culture. And it's really unfortunate. And I think that's one of the focuses of Title 13, is to kind of examine that. What is the core of that? Where, you know, what's the lifeblood inside of that causing this? And how do we move forward? How do we come back together?
So should we be more sympathetic to civil servants?
Oh, yes. I think that's one of the biggest things in the novel, is just talking about civil servants and, you know, the lamentations that civil servants have for their lots in life now, you know. And
yeah,
as a former civil servant, I can tell you it's often a thankless job, but it's, you know, you're at the whims of whatever the higher ups say. And, you know, now in this administration, there's a lot of civil servants that are fighting back. And I really think that that's an important thing, too, you know, that the civil servants, they're there to support the country. They're there to do a job. And, you know, when they feel like they can't do it, then, you know, they're going to take steps to do it instead anyway.
Quiet heroes in the background.
Exactly. Yes. And sometimes not so quiet, which is also nice to see. I know there's been some things popping up in rogue Twitter accounts and whatnot, and those are wonderful.
All right, Michael. Thanks so much. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.